While Hosen and Pahota held their corresponding roadblocks on Highway 5, Lieutenant John Murphy and the 30 Rangers from F Company crossed under the highway, one by one. They crept through a culvert and emerged on the other side in a dry wash that coursed along the east edge of the camp. This ravine trended to the south and was deep and weedy enough to conceal the men from the Japanese guards for the first 100 yards. But then it grew progressively shallower until it played out altogether, emptying into a flat field where the grass was clipped short. Lieutenant Murphy could see that reaching the rear of the camp would require a slow, laborious crawl within frighteningly close range of one Japanese guard tower and two fortified pillboxes. An extremely wary platoon leader, one F Company man called him kind of a skittish, nervous little feller. Murphy had a bad feeling as he contemplated this extremely risky traverse. His hunch was borne out almost from the start. When the long line of 30 Rangers inched beneath the guard tower on the northeast side of the camp, the first in a gauntlet of manned installations they'd have to sneak past, one of the Imperial Army sentries suddenly blurted out a warning in Japanese and drew his rifle. The F Company men pressed themselves even closer against the bank of the arroyo. They felt sure they'd been spotted, and prepared to leap up and charge the fence at the next unmistakable sign. Stealing peeks over the rim of the ditch, they could tell that the guard knew something was afoot. He was a mere 40 yards away, close enough so that the men could see that he was wearing eyeglasses. The sentry clutched his rifle and trained it nervously from side to side, aiming it straight at the ravine. The Rangers carried on a tense debate of whispers. "Shit, he's looking at us. Right at us. Should we blast him? No, Murph wants him to make the first move." The Rangers kept stone still in the ravine. The Japanese erupted in shrill discussion, but gradually the voices trailed off. After a few long minutes, the guard rested his rifle and appeared to relax, as though he'd decided the trouble either had passed or had merely been a vision of some kind, a figment of his bored ruminations. Murphy's F Company moved on. The men noticed that the Japanese guards had ceased looking down at the fields, that they seemed to be entirely focused on the sky. To Murphy's delight, the Black Widow was streaking impressively over the camp, and it proved to be a lifesaver for his platoon, just as it had been for Prince and his C Company. As the column of men writhed through the ditch, smaller groups of men fell out and took positions beneath each of the major Japanese fortifications along the eastern fence. There were two pillboxes and two guard towers, each of which appeared to be manned by two or three Japanese guards. The F Company plan was one of simple and decisive violence. Upon hearing the signal shot fired by Lieutenant Murphy in the rear, the men intended to annihilate these various nests simultaneously and with such concentrated force that the Japanese would have no opportunity to return fire. At approximately 7:30, the vanguard of F Company emerged from the ravine and crawled a final 200 yards on hard, open, well-mown turf. This was the part of the perimeter crawl that Murphy dreaded most. All that enabled them to pass through it was a bit of incredible good fortune. With the sun now completely set, the camp environs were plunged in darkness, and would remain so for only 25 minutes before a full moon would launch itself over the Sierra Madre, washing everything in bright silver light. The timing was extraordinary, as if a magical black veil had been thrown over them just when they needed it most. Though the Rangers were no more than 20 yards away, the guards couldn't see them. "If there'd been even an ounce of light, we couldn't have made it that last stretch. No way," said William Proudfit of F Company. "But when we came out of that ravine, it was like ink." Sergeant Joe Youngblood, who was crawling alongside Proudfit, said he'd never seen a night so black in his life. "In the Philippines, when it got dark, it really got dark quick. We couldn't see our own rifles. We didn't have flashlights. It was a mystery how we saw enough to do anything." To reach their firing positions, the last remaining F Company men had to crawl, without realizing it, over the shallow, unmarked graves of untold numbers of Cabanatuan prisoners, coffinless crypts that had long since been plundered and disturbed by burrowing rodents and dogs. This was not the main Cabanatuan burial ground, but a smaller one, where, according to diagrams later found hidden inside the camp, the Japanese had interred the bodies of executed Americans. Sprawled among the molded remains of their countrymen, the Rangers squirmed across a field of pungent grass that smelled to some like wild sage. In the rear of the camp were several large Nipa barracks, where approximately 100 transient Japanese troops were quartered. If all went according to plan, every single one of these troops would be cut to pieces in what was supposed to be the raid's most ruthless point of attack. The barracks were situated off to themselves, in the extreme southern end of the camp, several hundred yards from the American section. The Rangers planned to rake these Japanese billets with such intense fire that not a single occupant would have a chance to flee. Murphy knew that the last thing Captain Prince wanted was a surprise coming from the rear while the C Company men escorted the prisoners out the front gate. Lieutenant Murphy was supposed to fire the inaugural shot, and the gravity of that assignment was beginning to weigh on him. He glanced at his watch and saw that it was 7:40, 10 minutes past the scheduled starting time. It had taken a little longer than expected for him and his men to sneak all the way back to the rear. Along the full length of the fence, all the way around to the front, where Prince and his men were waiting in what must have been agonizing anticipation, Murph knew that every Ranger ear was tuned to receive and instantaneously react to a single sound. He braced himself for the thunderous ferocity of 100 American weapons replying at once to his cue. It was a dazzling, unnerving feeling to hold such latent power in the tip of a digit. He brought his M1 rifle to his shoulder and switched off the safety. He drew a deep breath and settled his sights on a Japanese soldier inside the barracks, resting his index finger on the cool crescent of metal.